Welcome back to DASCO Up for Discussion, the podcast from the Down Syndrome Association of Central Oklahoma, where we talk about real issues, real resources, and real stories that impact families in our community. I'm your host, Sarah Sewell, and I'm the Executive Director for the Down Syndrome Association. And today we're covering a really important topic on women's health and Down Syndrome. Before we dive into today's conversation, I want to remind everybody about our upcoming Festival and 5K, which will take place Saturday, September 27th at the Myriad Botanical Gardens. Please make sure you register. You can come and walk and run. It's a celebration of all of our community. There'll be food, live entertainment, kids activities, vendors, and of course, our awareness walk and certified USATF 5K. Mark your calendars again for Saturday, September 27th at the Myriad Botanical Gardens in Oklahoma City. This year's goal is to raise more than $250,000, and every dollar supports individuals with Down syndrome and their families right here in Oklahoma. You can register, donate, or learn more about it at dsfestivaland5k.com. That's dsfestivaland5k.com, and we cannot wait to see you there. So, now on to today's episode. It's women often wear so many hats, mom, daughter, caregiver, professional, and sometimes their own health can take a back seat. But prioritizing women's health is essential, and it impacts many of our families. But not only caregivers and moms, we are also going to talk about women's health relating to Down syndrome. So that's why we have an expert here today, and he's also one of our board members. It's Dr. Mitchell West. He's a trusted OBGYN and advocate for women's health. So, Dr. West, welcome to our podcast.
Thank you. I'm super glad to be here.
Great. So let's just kind of deep dive in. Can you just kind of first tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure.
And kind of the history and what kind of got you involved with DASCO?
Yeah, absolutely. So I first got involved with DASCO when I came out of residency training. I went to undergraduate at OU, went to medical school at OU, got a master's before that in Texas at UNT Health Science Center, did residency training at LSU Shreveport, Louisiana in obstetrics and gynecology. Came back here, that was 2022, and joined the board. I joined because of my Aunt Suzanne. She passed away when I was, when I was in medical school. And then Kathy got us kind of got us roped in, got us to the fashion show, and so here we are. That's kind of my background as far as DASCO and as far as medicine goes. I've kind of tried to engage the medical side of DASCO, mm-hmm. and so that's kind of why we're here today.
Yeah. So what made you become an OBGYN? What intrigued you about that?
I always tell people that it was the last thing I thought of. I was like, yeah, listen, I don't know what I'm doing here. I don't have these parts. How does this work, right? I was planning to do internal medicine until right when I came back from Christmas break, my third year of medical school. We do our rotations third year, and wound up on the OBGYN service. And every week was something new that I liked. And I saw my first delivery, and I tell people a lot, you know, I don't remember how many times I cried in medical school, but I cried at my first delivery, and it was crazy. Nice. You know, you do this for long enough, you deliver a ton of babies. People say, oh, you know, does it ever get old? It doesn't. And that's why I'm so glad I did it. But I liked the variety. I liked that I could do preventative care. I could do obstetrics. I could do emergency, you know, trauma type care. We do it all. And so it's a really gratifying field.
Mm-hmm. So let's just kind of deep dive into some of those fields.
Sure.
And before we get into the topic about, you know, how this relates to Down syndrome, first just kind of give us an overview of why women's health is so important and kind of where do we start?
Sure. So, you know, a lot of, you know, to start the topic, it's just women's health has been overlooked for a very long time. A lot of our studies in medicine are men's studies, and we just generalize them to women. Turns out we have found out over the past decade or two that that's not how things work. And so we are. I would hope that, you know, we are pushing the envelope and learning more about women's health. It's important because there are a lot of preventable conditions that affect women. The things that I most commonly chase after are, you know, birth control, contraception, trying to ensure that every pregnancy is planned. the majority in Oklahoma, for example, are not.
Right.
And so that can be a huge dividing path for a person.
Right.
Pap smears, screening for cervical cancer, essentially a completely preventable cancer, but rates have fallen the past few years. And I've diagnosed, I think, 3 cases this year. It's bad. We can prevent that with a routine exam. Mammography, same idea. Mm-hmm. Breast cancer is unfortunately very common. Something like 12 to 13% of women just get it. And so mammograms are our best way to screen for that. And then as, you know, I take those patients from their younger reproductive years into menopause, we look at bone density, we screen for colonoscopies, for colon cancer, we manage hormone replacement therapy, which, you know, turns out menopause can significantly impact your quality of life.
Right.
And so that we kind of look at everything from birth all the way through into menopause and try to help people, you know, stay in control of their health.
Mm-hmm. What would you say, like, for, you've seen a lot of our moms. What do you think the number one thing is that we are not taking care of?
Well,
I'm just not doing on a routine basis.
I think you kind of alluded to it at the beginning is, you know, when you are, whether you have just, it's been thrust upon you to be the primary caregiver or you feel that is your responsibility, you just don't take care of yourself at all. I get a lot of patients who come in. I have patients who, you know, have kiddos with Down syndrome. They come to their appointments, you know, as far as always their kiddos, but they don't always come for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
The simple annual exam is where that starts. Just touch in with your OBGYN or with your PCP or somebody to have that conversation about, you know, hey, do I need a pap smear? Do I need a mammogram? When should that happen? Just going to that first appointment so we can have that discussion with, like, hey, this actually is important with you. Getting plugged into the system, that's kind of the most important first step, and that gets overlooked a lot of times.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that there's, like, a reason women are not doing that in particular?
You know, so I think part of it is some women have a distrust in the system because, again, like I've talked about, it's been very male-centric for a while. You know, a lot of women have had traumatic experiences, especially, you know, as it relates to gynecology, traumatic sexual experiences. It makes it very hard to go to the OBGYN sometimes. It can be triggering for people who have had assault or PTSD, these kind of things.
Mm-hmm.
The time is another big one. Cost is another one.
Yeah.
Nothing is cheap these days,
right.
And nor is healthcare.
Right. Yeah, right.
So, it's multifactorial. All of these things, you know, play a role. But I find that women who if you're able to establish with an OBGYN that you trust, those women come back. If they have a bad experience, I tell people all the time, especially my like 21-year-olds that come in for their first pap smear, the most important thing I do is make sure they have a good experience. The pap is important, but the most important thing is a good experience.
Right.
Or they won't come back.
So that recommendation is 21. Get your first pap smear.
So let's talk about paps real quick here. Yeah, so pap smear, 21 years old. I think a lot of people say, hey, the first time you become sexually active, should you have a pap? Or I was always told 18, and I was told every year. A lot of that is kind of older recommendations.
Mm-hmm.
The current guidelines, these are put out by an organization called ASCCP. They basically govern what we do for screening for cervical cancer. 21 is when you should begin. There are some exceptions, primarily for patients with like HIV. But 21, every 3 years up through age 30, and then it's every 5 years through age 65. Now, you can certainly get off that path if you start having abnormals or if you have a hysterectomy or what have you.
Mm-hmm.
That makes it, you know, more or less frequent. But 21 is when that should happen.
Mm-hmm. So I'm just going to dive into
this.
Let's do
it.
Because I know a lot of people that struggle with menstrual cramps.
Sure.
What do you do? How do you prevent, or how do you manage that? Because some people don't have them as bad.
Sure.
Some people have them extremely, they're horrible, like throwing up and, you know, heating pads and the whole nine works. So how do we manage that on so many levels, or how do you recommend that with your patients?
So a lot of that starts, I mean, as simple as it sounds, with a good history and physical. For some women, they just have painful periods, and that's the whole story. And, you know, there are ways to treat that, whether that's with like some simple medications, even like high-dose ibuprofen used purposefully around the time of menses can be useful. People always think, oh, he's just going to say birth control pills. I am going to say birth control pills. it's a hormonal problem typically, and so that is a good first line. But there are other options too. IUDs, so you're not taking a pill all the time. But again, this is all skipping the evaluation. Sometimes there are structural causes that are on the inside. People wind up with, you may have heard of endometriosis.
Yes, I've heard
right?
That.
So that's a condition where the lining of the uterus actually escapes out of the uterus into the belly, and that tissue might be by the ovary or by the colon or by the bladder, and it doesn't know where it is, so it bleeds every month, and that can be very painful. So all that to say, it's a comprehensive evaluation and usually leads to some sort of medication to help either control cycles or control the pain.
Mm-hmm. So I am going to dive into talking more about now relating how this relates to women and young girls with Down syndrome.
Sure.
Because we get questions here, you know, I've had a little girl, oh my gosh, how am I going to manage when she starts her cycle,
sure,
goes through puberty, and we're like, it's going to be fine. I mean, I've been through it with my daughter, so I kind of give them, you know, my take on it. But I know at the National Down Syndrome Convention a couple of years ago, there was a session on women's health, and the National Down Syndrome Society put out a women's health guidebook that I shared with you,
yes,
and you'd already read, and you know all about that. So I kind of just want to kind of go into that,
yeah,
and kind of give some highlights from what you've read from it, and then we can talk more about, you know, some other, because I know one couple things that are really important relating to our families is, when do I start them on birth control?
Sure.
Do I let them have a cycle or not? How do we manage the pain when,
sure,
they do? And, you know, all in all, we want our kids to have this normal experience. And from a mom, I didn't want to take that away from Kirsten, because,
sure,
she's going to have to learn how to manage that. That's a life skill. That's an independency skill. And quite frankly, she does just fine with it. But kind of get started with that, and then we can talk more about the markers that we're supposed to look,
sure,
for along the way.
You know, one of the things that I try to stress to people when I talk about women's health with Down syndrome is that they have the same problems that any other woman,
right,
has.
Right, they do.
Sometimes they have problems expressing them
right,
in the same way, especially things like painful periods. Hey, I've got a tummy ache. It only happens, you know, this certain time of the month, kind,
uh-huh,
of thing, right? So, number one, just being aware that these things are going to happen, you know, if your daughter, you know, starts having cycles. Be aware of the pain. Be aware of changes in bleeding. For the most part, their cycles behave very similarly,
yeah,
to patients who don't have Down syndrome. You know, when should you start worrying about that? When should you see the gynecologist? If they have a pretty normal cycle, it's actually not completely necessary to go in right away to see a,
right,
gynecologist. Do they need a pelvic exam? Not necessarily.
No.
Mm-hmm. You know, there are several reasons they might, but just to go in and say, hey, I think my daughter's having painful periods, mm-hmm, that does not have to start with an exam or, frankly, even with a gynecologist. That can be with your primary doctor if they're,
uh-huh,
comfortable managing that, or that can be with an OBGYN. Again, that evaluation is usually pretty similar, but in those early teenage years, whenever, mm-hmm, those cycles start to become bothersome, they can take things like ibuprofen, you know, as long as they don't have a medical problem that would prevent that. They can be on birth control. You know, we talked some about, you know, when should you start birth control? Should you even be on birth control? How does that work? Patients with Down syndrome are able to be on birth control. There is some mixed data about clotting disorders in,
yes,
patients with Down syndrome.
That was mentioned at, yeah, at the session too, and some parents had expressed that. But
yeah,
I mean, Kirsten's been on birth control,
sure,
for a long time, and she doesn't have any issues with that.
You know, we talk a lot about you know, birth control. You know, it's super, super safe. There are risks of increasing blood clots, though.
Mm-hmm.
We don't always talk about that because the alternative could be pregnancy, which is far worse with clotting potential.
Right.
So we usually say, hey, it's worth it to be on birth control. But you got to be aware of that. And if it shakes out that there is some increased risk of clotting, well, that may be something where we talk about other options. Birth control pills, specifically ones with estrogen in them, which is the majority of pills, are the ones that get you in trouble with clotting risks. Progesterone-only pills, the Depo shot, IUDs, Nexplanon, and we can talk about, you know, pros,
yeah,
and cons of that later, but those don't have that same risk. So,
okay,
actually, those are other options, too, if that's something that you end up going in that line.
Mm-hmm. So what would you recommend is the safest method, or is it just individualized?
It is. You know, if you're are good with pills and you're comfortable with them being on them, birth control pills are fine. I don't think the data yet is convincing enough to say, hey, if you have Down syndrome, you can't be on a birth control pill.
Okay.
We're definitely not at that point from the data that I've seen. So I would just recommend for most women starting with the birth control pill. You know, when we talk about hormonal control, birth control pills are usually the most common. There's actually, mm-hmm, an over-the-counter birth control pill now called the O-pill.
Okay.
It's progesterone only, so it doesn't have that same clotting risk, but it doesn't have the same bleeding control either. So,
okay.
So the regular pill is usually a good first line. The patch, if they're okay with the sticker, if you think they're going to go peeling it off, maybe not the best
thing. Maybe not the best thing,
right?
Yeah.
The pill, the good thing is, once it's down, you're good.
Yeah.
The vaginal ring is an option, maybe not the best option for,
yeah,
a lot of patients.
Yeah, because that
with Down
has
syndrome
to be vaginally inserted.
It does.
That
it stays
might be
in
a little too much.
Exactly. So if they're,
yeah,
uncomfortable with that, I would not push it,
yeah,
in that direction. The Depo shot works well, but it can cause weight gain. A lot of our kiddos with Down syndrome,
yeah,
actually, the majority of them have obesity issues.
Yes.
So that's not usually what I would push them towards. Ultimately, birth control pills. we kind of talked a little bit before uh-huh. about, you know, what are some other options? IUDs are an option, or the mm-hmm. Nexplanon is an option. The Nexplanon is the rod that goes in the arm. These are both implants. Uh-huh. IUDs, if I can find my badge, I've got a little, I keep IUDs on my badge because I use them all the time. They're little devices that go inside the uterus itself. So okay. the catch is they don't feel very good to have them placed. And for patients with Down syndrome, we talk a lot about sedation uh-huh. versus, you know, placing it in the OR. Why would you even consider that if you could do pills? Well, it doesn't have the same risks of clotting. Usually has very good bleeding profile. And as far as birth control, these can last up to 8 years.
Yeah. For and the hormonal ones. If you can't swallow very well, that's another
issue. A lot of our kids
issue.
Have issues with swallowing, right?
So, yes.
I'm not saying that every, you know, kid with Down syndrome needs to go to the OR, go to sleep, and have IUD.
Right.
But if that's something that, you know, you're interested in, that is an option.
Mm-hmm. I will say, Kirsten learned her days of the week by taking her birth control.
So that is another option, too, for developmental milestones.
We kind of use it as an OT option. Yeah. And learning her days of the week and then, you know, counting your pills out. Yep. So it does have some other benefits too,
I think most
too,
people are
going to
be
say.
On pills. And that's where I would start for most families.
Okay. Okay, great. And so I know I was always concerned, like, when is she going to start puberty? Is it going to be sure. different from the other a typical child? And it wasn't. Like,
it's
my
best.
Doctor said, it's going to start the same mm-hmm. as when you and your family started. So she was about 12.
Yeah.
So
a lot of other milestones, you know, growth spurt, those kind of things. Obviously, some of the developmental milestones can be delayed. But the menstrual cycle seems largely unaffected.
Mm-hmm. Do you see the women... or girls are starting their periods earlier, or is it still about the same? Or have you read any research
you know,
about that?
In my practice, actually, I don't see a lot of the younger girls. A lot of them end up seeing their PCPs, uh-huh. and then they struggle for however many years until they finally come see
right.
me with, you know, the bleeding or the pain.
Uh-huh.
So I've not seen data on that. I have heard discussion of that, but I don't have a great answer on that.
Okay. And I know, you know, as Kirsten's gotten older and now she's 19, I've been taking her with me to my gynecologist.
I think it's a great idea.
And there was discussion about this in the session that I attended about, you know, getting them more comfortable
sure.
with the surroundings and the gown. And of course, you know, Kirsten was like, what are you doing, Mom? She
right.
had lots of questions. We won't go into all of that. But that was kind of my first thought is I just take her with me
sure.
to meet the doctor.
Just a little desensitization.
Yes. And what they're doing and just knowing that they're not hurting Mommy, that
sure.
she's checking me, and that this is, you know, to make sure that my insides are healthy
right.
as well as my outsides. And, you know, she kind of understood that, and now it's just like not a big deal. So if you want to talk a little bit about
I think that's a good idea.
That sensitivity issue, because obviously our kids are going to young
sure.
girls are going to have to do this at some point. So,
you know, this kind of, you can piggyback at talking about boundaries and when it is okay, and teaching them that a doctor doing an exam is an okay
right.
Boundary to be crossed. The American Academy of Pediatrics recommends at very young ages and repeatedly every 3 to 4 years talking about boundaries with privates and those sorts of things.
Uh-huh.
And that's, I think, showing as an example is a great way to start that. You know, we kind of talk about strategies to change the exam and how to make them more comfortable. A lot of our kids with Down syndrome can actually tolerate a pelvic exam.
Yeah.
A lot of them can't. And so
right.
there's different strategies as far as positioning and walking them through. And we talk about this idea of, you know, allowing them to show you versus you, you know, taking control of the exam,
right.
if that makes sense. But I think starting out early and trying to explain the exam,
mm-hmm.
explain that, hey, the doctor is okay to do this to you. You know, it's our family only and our doctor. Getting that ingrained can be a struggle, but that's an important thing to start with.
And I know the Adult Down Syndrome Clinic in Chicago, they have visuals for this.
Uh-huh.
So
a lot of clinics are not going to, unfortunately, have that.
Right.
Some will, some won't.
But I know we have resources here, so if anybody of you out there listening, if you need resources to get those pelvic exams, they are out there, and
sure.
And we'll be happy to share those with you, because we don't want anybody to feel uncomfortable. We just
yeah.
want everybody to be safe and
yeah.
happy. And one of the things I want you to share about, it, which is kind of a controversial subject amongst some of our females, is the Gardasil shot.
Sure.
And just your take on that as a professional,
yeah.
And you know what that might mean for a child with or adult with Down syndrome, and what it, and if there's, I think the one question that was asked a lot is, you know, what are the side effects?
Sure. So Gardasil, and for those that don't know, Gardasil is a vaccine against HPV. If you Google HPV, you're going to see a couple different things. HPV is the virus that causes genital warts, but we would actually call that a relatively low-risk strain of HPV. high-risk HPV is what causes cervical cancer. And that itself does not have a lot of symptoms. And in fact, you may have no symptoms. It is technically an STD. I always tell patients, it's not like gonorrhea, chlamydia, where, again, you may have an odor or irritation. HPV, you get it. If you've ever been sexually active, there's like an 80% chance you've been exposed to it. So everybody gets it. And most people just clear it. And if you clear it promptly, it typically goes away without causing problems. But if it lingers, it starts to cause precancerous or, God forbid, cancerous changes on the cervix.
Right.
When you're 21 to 29, typically we don't actually even test for HPV. Frankly, it's just assumed that a lot of women in their 20s are going to be positive. But we look for the actual precancerous changes. In your 30s and onward, we actually add on some HPV testing. So all that to say,
During the pap smear.
Correct.
Okay, so you're testing for all that automatically.
Yes.
And is that something that is routine with every physician, or do you have to request it?
It should be.
Okay. Okay.
So these are again, back to ASCCP guidelines. There are plenty of docs who are screening more or less frequently or not doing mm-hmm. it. Between, again, 21 and 29, the HPV testing is usually only if there's an unclear result.
Okay.
And we'll reflex that out. So Gardasil, you know, although pap smears are fantastic, I love a pap smear to prevent, or sorry, to detect. Gardasil is to prevent getting HPV in the first place. Safe sex is first line, but Gardasil, you know, it, to your point about vaccines, I think even just in the past 5 years or so, people have had a lot of questions about vaccine safety and, you know, should I really get this? Do I need it?
Right.
Gardasil, you know, the way I sell it, it's a vaccine for cancer. That, you know, usually is a pretty easy way to have that conversation. A lot of vaccines are hit and miss. I love the flu shot, but some years it's only like 50% effective. Gardasil is like 98 to 100% effective against
wow.
the 9 most cancer-causing strains of
HPV. I didn't know that. It's
fantastic. Ideally, it would be given, you know, before your kiddos become sexually active in their early teenage years. But it actually has been expanded now up through age 45. Adults can get it as well. A lot of adults, especially in their 30s and 40s, were missed because it was only approved through age 26 previously. So now, all the way up through age 45. In your early teenage years, it's a 2-dose series. It's a 3-dose series after age 15. All that to say, I absolutely recommend it because, again, it is there to prevent cancer. A lot of people have questions about should boys get it? Mm-hmm. They're not getting pap smears. They don't have a cervix, so should they get it? We recommend it for two reasons. Number one, boys can still get oropharyngeal cancers in their throat from oral sex. So the Gardasil vaccine is helpful for them in that. And two, you know, frankly, it's a population strategy. If fewer boys have HPV, fewer girls have HPV.
I see.
And so, long story short, I love the Gardasil shot.
We're as not far gonna be as, spreading it.
Exactly. That's the idea. Because you don't, again, people don't know if they have mm-hmm. it. Men don't get tested. And women only get tested if they have PAPs. Side effects-wise, it's like any other vaccine. You know, you can have some soreness at the site of mm-hmm. injection. You may have like a flu-like illness for 12 to 24 hours. I had Gardasil and it just felt like a regular vaccine. I didn't get sick or anything, but some people will have that.
Yeah, just some mild symptoms.
Exactly. Aches, fever.
Yeah.
But the majority of folks are not going to have anything significant. You know, again, back to, you know, some questions about vaccines. The vast majority of vaccines, the risk of a legitimate injury is going to be in the one in, you know, thousands to hundreds of thousands type of numbers.
So and so as the young teenagers, after their 3 doses, they don't have to get it again.
They're good.
They're good for lifetime.
Lifetime.
They don't have
mm-hmm.
to worry about it, and then their chances of getting cancer
are significantly reduced. There are a ton of, there's 20, 30, 40, 50, there may even be 100 strains of HPV, but the ones that most commonly cause cancer are contained in that vaccine, and so that's the goal.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's really interesting. I didn't know.
Yeah, a lot of people don't.
Our pediatrician, you know, they just kind of say, here are the vaccine lists,
right.
and which ones do you want to get? And I think the concern amongst our families is, my daughter is probably not going to be having sex. However, you and I both know that the sexual assault rate is extremely high
sure.
amongst our community. And can you talk a little bit about that? Because I know you've
yeah.
had some experience in that area.
Yeah, so I will tell you, so, you know, to the original point, you know, a lot of these kids not having intercourse, you know, by choice, something like maybe 5 to 10% will just choose to have intercourse. So, you know, especially for, you know, our parents with younger kiddos that say,
yeah.
well, that's a long way off. It's never going to be an issue. A lot of them are having intercourse.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, a lot of them are not choosing to have intercourse, but are winding up with assault.
Yes.
You know, again, the numbers probably are low reportings because
uh-huh.
people don't like to talk about this.
And well, they're not reported all the time.
Exactly.
Right.
The lowest I have seen is up to like 1 in 4, which
yes.
That is a shocking number, actually. Yes. And I know there's other numbers out there that have been way higher. Mm-hmm. So it's a real deal. And that goes back to the original conversation about talking about, like, you know, what areas should not be touched by people, stranger danger, these kind of things. Right. And even there's recommendations for talking about with your kid that they can become pregnant. Mm-hmm. Some, you know, may even, I mean, in the very rare case, talk about choosing to actively pursue that kind of thing. So these are all important conversations that are tough to have, but that parents should be having, potentially with their physician involved, to teach their kiddos about their body.
Yes, and we talk a lot about that through our OT camps and in a very appropriate way.
Sure.
And through our self-advocacy center. And mainly we kind of start off with, your kids don't really want to be hugged.
Sure.
So that's kind of the baseline where we start. And as our, you know, adults or our teenagers start to move into adult care, can you kind of go through the guideline and mention some things about what, like, when should we do breast screenings for our adults with Down syndrome? When should they, you know, also be checked for other women's health issues?
Sure.
And menopause? Like, what does that mean for girls with Down syndrome?
Sure. So, you know, breast cancer, an interesting thing occurs, and we've talked about this, in Down syndrome, that although they are typically at a much higher risk for blood-type cancers, leukemias,
right.
They're actually at a much lower risk for solid tumors.
Right.
Great news. We love that.
Right.
Breast cancer being one of those. And
yes.
So it's kind of controversial, breast cancer screening. Routinely, we recommend breast cancer screening. It depends on the organization you look at. ACOG, the group that governs OBGYNs, recommends starting at 40. And having an annual mammogram. Patients should also be, you know, once in a blue moon doing an exam. You don't have to do like a daily exam, but in the shower, breast awareness is the term we use now.
Right.
If you notice a lump or bump, bleeding, milk production, go see your doctor. But mammograms should be annual. The number, we talk in medicine a lot about the number needed to treat. How many mammograms do I have to do to catch a cancer? And I'd have to look up the actual numbers, but for Down syndrome, those numbers get really, really high.
Really?
Because it's so uncommon to have breast cancer, fortunately.
Yeah.
The guidelines are not changed. They are still recommended to have an annual breast exam. They're still recommended to have pap smears on their usual schedule.
Okay, great to know.
But again, you know, guideline hat off for a second. Again, this is a conversation you need to have with your doctor.
Right.
You know, back to pap smears. Public exams, some of our kiddos are going to do great with that. Some are going to find that to be very traumatic. Is that worth doing? That's a conversation to have with your gynecologist. Same with mammograms. They can be not super comfortable.
Right.
And if you're a young adult, you know, we don't start till 40, so if your adult is doing just fine with them, great, get a mammogram. You should.
Uh-huh.
But just know that the absolute risk in that syndrome is actually quite low when it comes to breast cancer.
That's good to know. And I'm assuming as far as our adults, women with Down syndrome age into adulthood, you're going to treat them the same through the menopause thing, as far as
correct.
The hormone replacements and things like that.
You know,
or would it change any a little bit?
It shouldn't a whole lot. I have not run into a lot of patients with Down syndrome and menopause. It's pretty uncommon. And I'd have to look up if the age is earlier. I would suspect that it is. I believe that it is. I looked at this a few months ago.
Right.
Of course, now it's left me.
Right.
But there's no reason that I'm aware of that they could not be on hormone replacement therapy. Hormone replacement therapy, in a lot of ways, it's kind of a safer type of birth control.
Uh-huh.
And we use it, you know, for those that are unaware, a lot of folks come to me and say, hey, I'm, you know, this age, should I just be on hormones? The answer is no. Generally speaking,
okay.
The two reasons to be on it, either you went through menopause way too early, you know, you walk in and you're 20 years old and you stopped having cycles, not great. Or you're in menopause and having hot flashes. That is the real indication for hormone replacement. So all that to say, if you have, you know, an adult with Down syndrome who has stopped having cycles, who now is starting to have, you know, mood changes, starting to have vaginal irritation, starting to have hot flashes, just breaking out in sweats at night, maybe it's worth talking.
Or
not sleeping. And that, you know, what confounds that is that we do see an increased risk in things like Alzheimer's and dementia, obviously.
Right.
You know,
that is correct. After the age of 40, yeah.
Yeah, I think a lot of folks know now that is because one of the genes that controls a specific protein that makes these plaques in Alzheimer's, it's located on the 21st chromosome.
It is.
And so
yes.
if you have more of that, which they do, you're going to have a higher incidence of Alzheimer's disease and, in general, dementia.
Yeah.
And so a lot of times I think, you know, things like hot flashes and stuff kind of fall behind when those issues do arise. And that can be up to the majority of folks with Down syndrome.
Okay. Well, that's interesting to know. I know I've been to seen several studies where it's like 90% after the age of 40.
It gets really high.
Have a higher increase of Alzheimer's and dementia, which is a scary, scary.
It really is. And when we've talked some, or maybe Kathy and I, about there's kind of this emerging condition described as Down syndrome, disintegrative disorder.
Yes.
And that, you know, so we talk about, you know, some of the issues as we get older. Uh-huh. Actually, in like the older teen, early 20s population, yes. We start to see regression sometimes.
We do, yes.
And it can be really scary. It can be issues with sleep. It can be, you know, not eating and just a kind of a regression in, you know, whether that's social skill level or habits. Those are things that, again, your doctor needs to know about if that's happening. Not entirely sure why that happens.
Right.
It kind of does.
We just notice, or I've noticed personally with my daughter, when she has behavioral changes, it's something related to her health, whether it's an ear infection or hormones or something else. One thing I wanted you to maybe touch on, because I know this is common amongst our community, are the boils that our young girls get, and those can be really painful.
Yeah.
Any suggestions of how to,
sure.
And I don't know quite the medical term for it, so you can
fill me in
that, but I know it's the hair follicle, and it's not so much a ingrown hair. It's just the way that
it's just a little follicle, infection of the follicle. It's a folliculitis, which is a boil. That is one of the...
And it's down on their vaginal area, which is very painful.
That is one of the three most common skin conditions that people with Down syndrome get.
Yes.
Along with like seborrheic dermatitis.
Yeah.
But boils are pretty common. Lifestyle things, breathable panties is a useful thing. If we're getting hot and we're sweaty, you know, make sure we're trying to stay cool. But when they happen, what do you do? Warm compresses is the first line treatment. So if you can, up to 3 times a day, get a wash rag that is, I'm not going to say like, you know, uncomfortably hot, but pretty warm to steam the area. That can allow that pore to open up a little bit and drain. As they start to get bigger, you know, if it's just like there's a little follicle, it's angry, then it goes away. Great. Love that. If it's staying, though, that probably does need to be seen. When these get larger, they do sometimes actually need to be drained.
Yeah.
And that is not super fun.
No, it's not.
But that can happen.
We've had experience in that field. It's not a fun thing. And then we've got to go on antibiotics. And
there are antibacterial soaps that you can get over the counter.
Okay.
But a lot of times, if it gets to that point, antibiotics and drainage is the answer.
Yeah.
And it's not always the most fun thing.
Yeah, and it is very common. That was one of the top topics at the discussion. And so I'm glad you were able to address it. Is there anything else about women's health that you'd like to share that we haven't touched on?
You know, again, I think the thing that I would just, you know, reiterate is that, you know, treat your daughter with Down syndrome just like you would anybody else, right? Take them to the doctor. The recommendations are the same, but oftentimes some of the screening is more frequent. At early ages, vision screening, hearing screening, thyroid checks. A lot of folks get hypothyroidism. Again, consider talking to a gynecologist when you hit 21 and talk about pap smears. You know, talk about birth control. Just take a kid to the doctor and have those conversations. And you may find that, you know, the things that they recommend to you may not be the best decision for you and your family, and that's okay.
Yeah.
But, you know, the doctor's goal is not to, like, you have to do this. The doctor's goal is to say, hey, these are the risks and benefits of what I'm recommending, and then you can make the best decision for you and your family.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that speaks for everyone. I mean, like I tell Kirsten, we have to take care of the outside of our body as well as the inside of our body. And that's kind of the basic of where we started. And then for the new moms out there that have little girls, don't be afraid.
Yeah.
They'll manage their periods just fine. Yep. They do wonderful. And I know there's so many different pads and things that they can use now. I know we had to try several different ones before we found the ones that, you know,
some will be irritating, some will cause boils.
Just like with everybody else.
Exactly. You know, a lot of it just comes down to trial and error and talking to somebody who's done it.
Yeah.
One of the things I would say also is just, you know, and this is back to just general DASCO things, is just be an advocate for your daughter.
Yes.
You know, one of the things, when I started studying about Down syndrome specifically, what was more traumatic to me than the medical stuff was the societal stuff.
Yes.
And even, you know, in our lifetimes, there are patients with Down syndrome who have been denied routine medical care by very respected healthcare institutions in this country.
That's so sad.
It's wild. Because they're just seen as not the same level of person. It's grotesque. All that to say, you know, be willing to take the first level of that advocacy is just for your family. Take them out, get them healthy, and then come see us for the the next levels of it.
Yeah, and I'm so glad you came today. I mean, you're always such a wealth of information, and I know we talk a lot about our health around here with you when you stop by.
That's what we're here for.
And we just really appreciate you coming today and sharing all of your wisdom. And
absolutely.
It's nice to have a doctor on the board. I will say that.
I was on call for you guys. That's fine.
Yeah, he's always on call for us, and he'll be on call for you all as well.
That's right.
But this has just been really helpful and encouraging. And I would just tell everybody, if you have any questions, you know, put those in the comments or email us. Let us know. I can get those to Dr. West, and he can answer your questions privately, or you can go see him as well as your OBGYN. But thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure. But before we go, just one quick reminder to join us on September 27th. It's on Saturday for the Down Syndrome Festival and 5K at the Myriad Botanical Gardens. Whether you walk, run, or cheer from the sidelines, you'll be making a difference for our families across the central Oklahoma. You can register or donate at dsfestivalin5k.com. That's dsfestivalin5k.com. And we'd love to see you there. And Dr. West will be there, and we're going to be cheering on Suzanne in her memory. So we appreciate you being part of our team. And thanks again for tuning in for DASCO Up for Discussion. If you enjoyed today's episode, please share it with a friend, leave a review, and subscribe so you never miss one of our conversations. Until next time, keep learning, keep growing, and keep advocating. Bye.
Bye-bye.